From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the effort to help Latinos climb the corporate ladder in Milwaukee.
Later, how the technology behind Bitcoin could help refugees prove their identity.
Then how the Native Americans who first inhabited Wisconsin viewed the night sky.
So the Big Dipper, I often describe as a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle. The Big Dipper was seen as different things from the different nations.
And why Wisconsin's rich cheese tradition is not just about the cows who live here.
We don't only make a lot of cow's milk in Wisconsin, but we also make a lot of goat's milk and sheep's milk. In fact, we produce more goat's milk and sheep's milk than any other state.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Latinos represent one of the fastest-growing demographic groups in Wisconsin. Data from the state shows nearly 286,000 Latinos call the state home, an increase of 47% since the 2000 U.S. Census. But that growth has not been reflected in the leadership in Milwaukee's business community.
Information from the organization Hispanic Professionals of Greater Milwaukee, or HPGM, shows that only 3% of executives in the city and 7% of managers are of Latino origin. Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo spoke with several people working to change that.
Griselda Aldretti is president and CEO of HPGM. Carla Loera is a student and president of HPGM's chapter at UW-Milwaukee. And Raquel Fulmanowitz is director of U.S. Community Affairs for BMO Harris Bank. Fulmanowitz offered her theory on why the numbers are lagging.
I can't speak broadly as to why, but you know, for me and my situation, I had sponsors and advocates that weren't Latinos that kind of helped me along the way and guided me, made introductions for me. And I think unless we have that as part of just a way to have professional growth and development for our existing Latinos kind of moving into the ranks of upper management, like, that's just critical. I see it more and more, given that a lot of these companies have very robust and strong diversity and inclusion programs. But it's taken a while for us to get there compared to Chicago or other cities that are nearby or are of our size. So for me, like, that has been critical. I don't know if you can speak to.
Well, I mean, I think it's also kind of like, I mean, we could point it out to even just like women, right? Getting women to certain positions. I mean, you talk about what it means, what diversity and inclusion means. It means different things to a lot of different people. And I think, you know, people just sometimes say like, there's all these jobs and we just don't have the bodies to fill them. But I think unless we really prepare our Hispanic community to enter those roles, I think we'll continue to be overlooked. And I think that's why we're trying to play that role. And, you know, for example, Rising Latinos really looks at, you know, what does it take to get to that senior level and then C-suite positions? And that it requires a lot of different things. And there you really do need to be polished. You need to know how to budget. You need to know your numbers inside and out, but also your presence and how people view you. Do people want to work for you and with you? I mean, all of the skill sets that sometimes we overlook, but we think, like, I'm qualified. I have the master's. I have the MBA. And why are you not giving me that promotion? Well, how do people react to you? Do I inspire a team or a division? I mean, that's what corporations are looking for. And when you have a sponsor that has been sponsoring someone else and you're just left on your own and you think that if you work really, really hard, you'll get promoted, that's not how it works. And I think that that's where we've come in and said, if you are serious about diversifying your workforce, then you have to be intentional and let us help you be that sort of that connector in the middle.
And so, Carla, you are president of HPGM at UWM. Could you tell us a little about your experience as a Latina coming out of high school and going into college? What was like that for you?
Well, that transition was obviously a little bit difficult just because I was the first one in my family to be going into college. My parents hadn't gone into college, so it was a whole different experience. I didn't really have somebody to guide me. So entering into like an organization like Hispanic Professionals of Greater Milwaukee, it's really helped me realize what that how I'm supposed to be preparing, networking, figuring out what I'm supposed to be doing. There is so much help that I have been receiving that my advisor couldn't necessarily give me. My advisor just tells me what classes I'm supposed to be going to versus when I am attending like conexiones or different student activities where you are meeting students who are just as motivated as you and are trying to figure out what is the next step, how are we supposed to progress. And it's just helped me.
What sorts of impact have you seen so far in the Hispanic community in Milwaukee?
Well, you know, we've been around for, as Raquel said, 17 years, but it wasn't until, I would say, 6 years ago when we intentionally wanted to go after college students. So that alone, right, I mean, you're changing the perception of what a Hispanic professional looks like. And we tell all of our students that you are professionals and professionals in the making, that we want to make sure by the time you graduate, your resume stack up to your non-Hispanic counterparts. So the impact has been that we've grown from just Milwaukee-based to we have 11 student chapters across the region where we extend to Waukesha and now Madison as well. And so our breadth of the work that we're trying to do with college students, I mean, we added almost 980 college students since 2012 we began this work. And then as far as programming, I mean, we've launched a board pipeline initiative to get more Hispanics on boards. And then we also have our Rising Latinos that's focused on that middle management professional looking to get them into senior levels. And so from an impact perspective, you know, we throw a really good party, but we do more than that. I mean, that's just one event that helps us fund our year-long activities.
And so you mentioned the Rising Latinos. Mm-hmm. Why is it important for Hispanics to be in those high-level positions and the CEOs and those presidents?
Well, I think you still have people asking, like, the Hispanic community is growing, right? That's no secret. But people are still wondering almost, like, what to do with us. And they're asking themselves, like, how do we market to Hispanics or how do we get more Latinos in those positions? And the issue becomes that, you know, there needs to be advocates at different levels that can help push those individuals along because, you know, we're still learning how to network and navigate because a lot of us didn't grow up going to business dinners or golf courses to do the business, right? And when you also see a ceiling that you're trying to break, but there's not a lot of people trying to push you up, I think that's why we are saying we need to see more Latinos in those positions so that they can continue to open doors that we all need opened still at this place. And companies are hungry for that. It's just Milwaukee moves at a very small, like snail's pace sometimes.
Anything to add?
Well, I would just say that we have pretty much every company represented is part of our donor base for HPGM. So it's important for us to have a presence within their organizations because, as Grisela said, they are looking for Hispanic professionals to promote, to groom, to enter into those management trainee programs. And I just think HPGM serves such a critical role in our community to help prepare those individuals for those opportunities within corporate America. Oftentimes, like even within my workplace, in certain settings, I am the only person of color. And I want to see that change. And it's through organizations like HPGM that are helping to move the needle.
So, Carla, you mentioned to me that HPGM was going to die at UW, and it wasn't until last semester that you started it up again. And you also mentioned that you are a first generation. How many members of HPGM at UWM are first generation?
I would say no more than like 70% of them are first generation. A lot of them don't have somebody to look up to, which is why I absolutely admire you, Griselda. So it is something important that we need to see people like one women, Hispanics, doing something more than just what the statistics says. So getting all these students involved and trying to keep them active in HPGM at UWM is extremely important because HPGM gives us that opportunity to see people succeeding in this community, doing further, going further than just high school. Actually finishing school, getting a profession. So I think it's super important to just get these students involved and making sure that they can see all of the great opportunities that the world has out there for us.
I think, you know, when you talk about some of these chapters that struggle, I mean, a lot of the times these are students that are struggling navigating the system that is school, just period, right? And a lot of them, if you are first generation, just want to graduate so they can make their mom and dad proud, right? Because they're the first ones. But what we tell our students is that you need to think of college as a stepping stone, because you need to think beyond 4 years. And that's what we're preparing you for. And I think until students see it, they don't, you know, they might not think that what we're trying to do with them, you know, is like added work. But it really are the life skills, the wraparound services that is going to make them successful upon graduation.
I think it's also important to share, Griselda, the programming around financial literacy, because mm-hmm. these students are first generation, and so managing their finances is key. Mm-hmm. What does HPGM do there?
Yeah, so we work with our financial institutions. BMO is one of our top financial institutions that we turn to give some students, you know, what do you need at college, and looking at money as an asset, not as a necessity. And we talk about the budgeting skills, right? A lot of the, you know, college is expensive. A lot of these students are maxing out financial aid to, one, you know, afford the lifestyle that they think they want at this time, and two, also sometimes they're bearing the burden of helping their families. And so we try to have that conversation at not just the student level, but at the parent level, to really help understand that, you know, these are students that are the first to do something, but we need to prepare them for success and not overburden them. But those are life choices that we're trying to help with. And so really making sure that the students begin to look at their finances earlier rather than later, because we know that Uncle Sam is going to come to collect 6 months after graduation.
So, Carla, as a college student, can you relate to that, to the financial situation that,
oh, absolutely,
that comes in college?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have taken out loans, and obviously, my parents haven't necessarily taught me or guided me financially. So it sometimes, and schools don't necessarily teach you, like, this is what you're supposed to do, this is how you're supposed to do it. And so you're kind of just wandering into this world and being like, all right, school's here, I don't have $12,000, how do I get it? And so you usually think, oh, loans, I don't have to pay it now. And so I have attended some of these financial seminars, and they've actually helped me realize, like, money doesn't just grow on trees, and I just can't borrow money just because it's the easy way out. There are consequences, and there's so many different regulations and interests and all that stuff. So it's important to know, like, this financial system.
Well, ladies, I thank you guys for coming on to Lake Effect, and I hope success in HPGM.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Carla Loera is a student and president of HPGM's chapter at UW-Milwaukee. Raquel Filmanowitz is director of U.S. Community Affairs for BMO Harris Bank. And Griselda Aldretti is president and CEO of HPGM.
Keep listening. Why one of the hardest challenges facing refugees today is validating their identity. That story when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The refugee crisis is still a huge problem. It affects the developing world as people leave war-torn or famine-stricken countries and resettle in refugee camps, often in other developing nations. And it affects countries like the United States or Western European nations as refugees seek to build new lives in places with economic opportunities.
But those economic opportunities are not always accessible to refugees, sometimes because of immigration policies, but often because they have no way to validate their history or their identity. A former refugee now living in Minnesota is working to change that.
Hamza Warfa is Executive Vice President of Business Development for BankU, an app that uses the technological backbone of Bitcoin to help refugees reclaim their identity. He was in Milwaukee not long ago and joined us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What does it mean to not have a verifiable identity, and how does it affect what you're able to do and become?
Yeah, as a way of context, so I was born in Somalia. First 10 years of my life I spent in Mogadishu, peaceful Mogadishu before the war. But when the war happened, my family had to flee, and we came to a refugee camp known as the Dadaab refugee camp, a camp that was built for 70,000 people but became home for 600,000 people with facilities that was meant for 70,000 people. when my parents, who were very successful business, you know, entrepreneurs, came to Kenya, they lost who they were. So despite the fact that they had a long career, you know, successful business, they became nobodies. So we had a statistical number that we would use to collect food and water. So all the work that has been done was completely lost. And so what it meant for us is that as we moved from one camp to another, we had to repeat immunization, for example. We had to, despite the fact that some refugees have a high entrepreneurial spirit, they get services from NGOs, they repay back loans they get. So they have a record because life is about collection of activities and events. It's like starting your life all over again every time when you don't have an identity. So it has a huge implication on whether you stay in poverty or not and whether you have access to the global economy or not.
And the thing that really struck me as I was getting ready for this interview is that the average stay in a refugee camp is 17 years. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
That's a huge block of time that if you can't develop your own identity or collect the experiences to have that void in your life.
Yeah, I freshly remember a young person I met in the Dadaab refugee camp just last year. And he shared with me that his parents had 20 loans from, you know, the likes of like Danish Refugee Council, where they have successfully repaid back. But now many of them are being repatriated back to Somalia. So everything they have done in the camp, the education they have received, the loans they have repaid back, all of that do not become part of their record. So when they go back, when they are repatriated, it's like starting all over again. So, and then if they are resettling in the United States, in Milwaukee and Minneapolis and places like that, the first challenge that refugee experiences is that you're not even allowed to get a rental apartment because you need a history. And if you don't have a history, someone has to co-sign for you. And what happens is that resettlement agencies sometimes, you know, are able to co-sign for you to even rent. But there are instances where you might not even find anybody to do that for you. Imagine if you had came with your record where you can say, hey, look, I had 10,000 loans from Danish Refugee Council. UNHCR have given me this and I've, you know, repaid this amount of loan. I had a small shop in the camp. And guess what? I had education from so-and-so, and so I have a certificate. Yeah, it completely transforms your life. So you come with credit history as you rebuild your life and start, you know, new life in a new country, a new land.
So you mentioned loans, for example, from NGOs and other aid agencies. Have there ever been other attempts to help refugees establish these issues of identity in the past?
There hasn't been any successful attempt, you know, that has taken place yet. But because of new technology, most people know Bitcoin. But the technology that Bitcoin leverages is called blockchain. And blockchain is a decentralized distributed ledger. It empowers people to have a secure means to collect data and build a credit history without corporate control, without centralized database. Because right now, most of our data is corporate control. Even in the United States, you know, my health record sits with, you know, health clinic this, health clinic that. My education certificate is with San Diego State University, Springfield College, and so forth. Imagine a scenario where all of my data points are triangulated and I don't have to go through a centralized mechanism to get access. I own it. It's my own data. And I give permission to the networks, organizations, companies, banks that are providing services to me. And that's a huge transformative innovation that have just started, you know, because of blockchain technology.
Who then is in a position to validate that this information that you are supplying to BankQ is legitimate?
Yeah, so there's some multiple data points, some that don't even belong to the individual that uses. So just quickly, you develop your identity by through selfie, taking selfie, and you can attach multiple other data points. You can also connect with existing systems. With blockchain, there is no servers. There is, you know, it's not really even a database. It's a decentralized distributed ledger. The best example I use is, you know, the fax machine. So the first fax machine was useless because you needed a second fax machine in order for it to work. So you need to start with two fax machines, and then you start building the network that validates, you know, who you are. And just like in Facebook and LinkedIn, when you use your when you want to reset your password, they use data points that don't belong to you. For example, they will align five pictures of your friends, one of your friends and four others that you don't know, and they say, pick who do you know from here to verify your identity. So the verification happens in multiple ways. One way is that if you are working with NGOs and there's literacy issues and things like that, that NGO becomes your intermediary, the validator. And our system our platform allows us to connect with universities where you got your degree. So there is a way to request verification from institutions that provided services to you.
Well, and so again, give us a paint a picture. If this technology had been available while you were going through your own refugee experience, you and your family were, how would it have made a difference?
It would have uplifted us from poverty very quickly because life is about collection of activities and events. If we came and showed that my father had a successful livestock business and my mother had a very successful retail clothing business, that we were able to have our own small shop, we had transactions and activities happening, that would have, we would have been credit worthy. We would have been someone who is credible, you know. And it's like getting a mortgage, you know. You need your credit history in order to get a loan. For women farmers around the world, you know, some who the coffee that we enjoy here is made by women somewhere in the world. But unfortunately, she does not get credit for the work that she has done. And it has a huge implication. Where our name came from, BankQ, is that we, when we saw this interesting gap in poverty, how we approach poverty, was that in the Congo, South Kivu, my co-founder and our CEO was in the in South Kivu, and he came with a woman who made $200 from her business harvest. And she came to a bank and wanted to open an account. The teller said, "You are not. I cannot bank you, number one, because you're a woman, and number two, it was very cost prohibitive." But the teller told my co-founder, "I can bank you because you have history." So my colleague turned around and told the woman, "One day we'll bank you." So that's where our name comes from. So this has a huge, you know, upliftment, empowerment, and really dignity. It provides an opportunity for someone to feel dignified. They own their own data. They have a means to connect to the global economy. They can monetize the relationships they have with family members who might live in the West, who provide remittance money and, you know, things like that. So it moves someone from being dependent to independence, and someone to have an integrated set of records they can monetize. They can get tractor loan and things like that. You know, so for a woman, they have a 40% interest, for example, to get a tractor loan, as opposed to, say, men who get 10%. In part, it's because she doesn't have a way to build her credit history.
You mentioned one of the means of validation is taking a selfie, and I was surprised to learn that smartphones have proliferated as much as they have, even inside refugee camps.
Yeah, interestingly, when I went back to the same tent that I have lived before I came to the United States, 20 years ago, And what I saw in the Dap refugee camp, you know, in 2016 and 2017 was that, so there is no electricity, but yet 40 to 60% cell phone usage. And I asked, how do you charge your phones? People use solar lights to charge their phones. And one interesting experience we had in Zaatari camp in Jordan for Syrian refugees was that even the UNHCR and the systems did not know that the refugees created their own Facebook groups and they were selling products and services online, and they were monetizing those relationships, you know. What is empowering is that, you know, the technological advancement, the cell phone penetration is there. And as we move from, you know, the Internet of Things to social media to now monetizing the relationships that you have, it's a perfect timing for a blockchain solution to uplift people from poverty. So we, most people, as I said, associate blockchain with Bitcoin, but we don't do mining. We decouple the mining aspect of it. And we're using the core blockchain technology in a private permission network to make sure that people are able to feel secure as they use, you know. So it's much more secure than, you know, the Gmail, the Facebooks, you know, the things that we already use.
Hamza Warfa, thank you so much for taking some time to tell us about it, and really best of luck in your work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Hamza Warfa is one of the founders and executive vice president of BankQ, a Minnesota-based company that helps refugees validate their identity. Since its founding around 5 years ago, BankQ is in use with more than 25,000 people on 4 continents. You can find more information about it at wuwm.com.
Well, before there were European settlers, Wisconsin's Native Americans were trying to make sense of the night sky. Our astronomy contributor tells us how they saw it when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. There have been astronomers in Wisconsin for a long time. There's the Yerkes Observatory near Lake Geneva. There are astronomy programs at places like UWM and UW-Madison, and even a private observatory up in the North Woods.
But our astronomy contributor, Gene Creighton, tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that there were observers of the night sky well before there were PhD scientists here.
We were exploring indigenous voices, so there are at least 6 nations in Wisconsin who, of course, culturally had different ways of describing the sky, not only in terms of constellations, but also in terms of what they thought of the sun, the stars, the moon. And we had a collaboration with the Electa Quinney Institute where we could have students explore some of that information, the scientific and cultural information. So although, of course, I can't speak for them, I certainly got an education as the program progressed and as we unearthed more information. So for example, this time of year, I'm going to use 2 anchors because they're familiar, I think, to most people. So the Big Dipper, I often describe as a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle. The Big Dipper was seen as different things from the different nations. So the Big Dipper is often shown, and let's call it, I hate to say the word official, but it is the official designation of that patch of sky as Ursa Major, which is the Big Bear. And it's true that the Oneida people also see a bear there. And in fact, there's this beautiful story. The hunters are shooting at the bear, and the bear's tail is pointing to the earth, and that's when the blood hits the trees and the colors change. And that connects the position of the Big Dipper with the tail down to the fall.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love when people find stories that explain what they see. But there's also the War Club of the Ho-Chunk people. And I will tell you the story of the fisher, which is connected more to Ojibwe traditions. Are you ready for a story?
I am indeed. I'm always ready for a story.
Good. So honestly, I had not heard of the animal fisher before I learned this story. It is a small mammal in the weasel family. It is a carnivore, and it has a long tail. So the story goes that a long, long time ago, when animals could still talk to each other and to people, and spring was just about ready to burst, and the buds were on the trees, and the grass was turning green, the animals noticed that there were no birds. They hadn't seen any birds. They hadn't heard any sign of them at all. And they were worried because they knew that birds were definitely a package that came with spring. And if birds aren't coming, then that's a problem. So they all discussed what are they going to do now that the birds have mysteriously disappeared. And they decided that they were going to leap up into the sky through the hole in the sky, which is also known as the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades. And they were going to climb up the cedar tree, jump through the hole, and see where all the birds have gone. Well, then the animals were starting to argue, who's going to do this? And the bear said, well, I'm obviously too heavy, too big. I couldn't do that without breaking the tree. Porcupine said, I'm too timid. So the fisher, after many, many animals came and went explaining why they can't do it, the fisher said, I will do it. I will climb up the cedar tree and leap into the sky and see where those birds are. So that's what he did. He went through the hole, and he saw that all the birds were captives of the angry cloud spirits. They'd all been taken away. So he thought and thought, this fisher, and realized that he has this long tail. What he's going to do is he's going to whip it around fast, fast, and dissipate some of the cloud spirits, and they will lose their grasp on the birds, and the birds will be able to fly through the hole back to the animals. And indeed, all those birds were coming through, and all the animals were cheering back on earth. And just when the last bird was about to fly through the hole, and Fisher was about to fly after it, the angry spirits threw an arrow at his tail and ruined his aerodynamic scheme. And instead of jumping back onto the cedar tree, he actually leapt to the ground and died. All the animals were very upset, as you can imagine, that this brave animal finished his life so tragically. And they went to the creator and said, oh, we'll need to do something to honor this precious animal. So creator went to the ground and picked up some stones and tossed them into the sky, made the pattern of the fisher. And that's how we honor brave fisher who brought back all the birds to celebrate spring.
And so what do we call fisher?
Big Dipper.
That's the Big Dipper.
Yeah, or I should
the
say
the table. Yeah,
I mean, it's actually it is in fact the bear, right? So mm-hmm. The Big Dipper is part of the bear. And whereas we see a bear, if you will, it's very similar with the fisher, only it explains more naturally why it has a long tail. In the bear situation, we see that it has a long tail because the bear was put up in the sky. And his tail got yanked out of shape. This, of course, is a reminder that a lot of these patterns require imagination, and there is no profound reason to see one over the other. I think we can celebrate the richness of the different traditions because ultimately they do tell us how people looked up, connected to the sky, tried to explain what they can, and connect their traditions with what they see in the sky.
Yeah, it's something that's very human, mm-hmm. our need to do that wherever we are and whatever traditions we come from. When you were doing the programs, what did you find to be the thing that was most different between the way the First Nations and the tribes described what they saw and the way
Greeks and Romans and Europeans described what they saw.
Honestly, I was more struck about the similarities rather than the differences. So, for example, I believe it was the Oneida had different cool connotations with planets and hot connotations with stars. The moon they also classified as cool to separate things that make their own light, like stars, from things that just reflect light. So they had an understanding that those two things, even though they look bright in the sky, are different in nature. And, I mean, that's, I think that's pretty impressive. I also really liked one of the terms in Ojibwe. So the Ojibwe language is part of the Algonquin family of languages. So there's similarities among those languages, Potawatomi, Menominee, Ojibwe. These are similar, belong, I should say, in the same language family. So they were describing the Milky Way, among other things, as a string of stars. And if you consider that our galaxy is a spiral galaxy, that is such an evocative image, even though presumably they had no way of knowing that that's what our galaxy looks like from the outside. The fact that they have that reference, I think, is pretty mind-boggling, actually. Now, one of the patterns, if you will, that are different are the twins. So Gemini, I honestly think it looks, now it could be that I have my background, and that's why I think it really does look like two people standing side by side, but I know from the planetarium that it's a reasonably easy sell. There are two bright stars that are very similar in brightness, and they seem to be at the top of two stick figures. But the Potawatomi there see a beaver. So the two stars on the top are his ears. The star kind of in the middle is his nose. What we would call the arms, because they're holding arms at the shoulder, are his whiskers. The rest of the legs are his body, and there's a bit of a tail coming out. And again, you can see how people who live in the Great Lakes region need, of course, a bear in the sky, but they also need a beaver in the sky.
Absolutely. And yeah, and we kind of make the pattern of what we in some ways need to see.
That's right. What really connects to what we do and who we are and what is surrounding us.
I'm sorry that we can't go see it again.
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, we'll work again together and have another, you know, exploration of this fascinating topic.
Well, I am looking forward to having great conversations over the summer, Jean. And in the meantime, congratulations on the end of another semester, and we'll talk to you next month.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Jean Creighton directs the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and she's our regular astronomy contributor. She talked with Bonnie North, and you can listen back to all of their conversations at WUWM.com.
One more break now, and then we'll talk about some cheeses for your next picnic. They are not necessarily fancy ones, but they're certainly tasty. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. As you get ready for your Memorial Day weekend picnic or barbecue, don't forget the cheese. That's certainly one of the messages our contributor Jeanette Hurt would have you remember.
Jeanette is the Milwaukee author of a number of books on cheese and other food and drink, and from time to time she brings in some cheese to share with us and you. Hi, Jeanette. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
It is always nice to see you, and not just because you bring cheese with you, but
it's a side benefit.
Special bonus. Yes, exactly. And you brought a number of cheeses with you. I'm counting, what?
Four.
Four, yes.
They're all from Clock Shadow Creamery, which is just down the street from you, practically.
It is. And do these have a particular spring kind of feel to them?
Some of them do. But the other thing is there are some different cheeses. Let me introduce the cheeses
introduce
first.
Introduce our cheese plate, yes.
Okay, well, we have the Montague, which is an aged sheep and cow milk blend. It's just very nice. It's a really good munching cheese. Then you have a Colby, but what makes this one different, it's a double cream.
Okay.
They make the regular, they have one batch of milk, and then they skim the cream off of another cheese and put that in. So it's a richer, creamier Colby, but still very mild, very good for sandwiches. Then you have the Cream City Brick. And the most interesting thing about this particular cheese, it's made with the milk from the cows that go to State Fair.
Really?
So they, you know, there's a whole bunch of milking cows at State Fair. They get milk, the milk goes over to Clock Shadow, and they make this cheese. Huh. Then the other cheese, of course, is their Quark, which is a very, it's a fresh, creamy cheese. And this one is combined with the S.A. Bray chutney, a locally made chutney. And then, of course, I have some peach oolong tea. That brings me to the next thing, which is I'm going to be teaching a bunch of classes at this new cheesy event, which is called, appropriately, the Big Cheese at the Osthoff Resort. And that's Memorial Day weekend. So it's basically 3 days of cheese. They have cheese making classes, cheese dinners, and then all sorts of cheese classes.
And even if you were not presenting at this would be completely your kind of event.
Exactly. So I'm going to be teaching a cheese and cocktails class, and I'm also going to be teaching a cheese and tea pairing class, and then also doing an introduction. And it should be a really fun event. And there should be some cheesemakers from around the state, but also especially from sort of the northeast and north central Wisconsin, northeast central Wisconsin, if that's a part of our state. So
as long as Wisconsin is in the name.
Yes. So it's all Wisconsin cheese. It should be really fun. The other big news in terms of cheese right now is the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, which has been promoting Wisconsin cheese and dairy products forever, has changed its name to Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin because the board basically works for dairy farmers. Dairy farmers give them money to promote cheese and yogurt and milk, and they thought that was appropriate to explain because we are a dairy state and we are a dairy farmers state.
So the name puts the dairy farmers front and center as opposed to the marketers front and center.
Yes. And then one of their big pushes right now is, of course, you've got June Dairy Month coming up, and there's all sorts of breakfast on the farm, which if you haven't done it, is a fun event. And then in July, they have the American Cheese Society competition. They just, this past March, finished up with the World Cheese Championship. Unfortunately, unlike 2 years ago when a Wisconsin cheese was crowned grand champion, we were not grand champion. We still had five cheeses in the top 20 finals, but we didn't beat the European cheeses this year. We did, however, take home more prizes than in any other region in the world. But that's not surprising.
And so what was the grand champion, do you know?
The grand champion cheese was a French Basque hard cheese called Esquirou, pronounced Esquirou.
Okay.
And
you did not bring any of that?
No, I did not bring any of that.
Not available at Clock Shadow Creamery.
No, it's not. Clock Shadow just sells Wisconsin cheese and primarily cheese made at Clock Shadow or Cedar Grove.
So let's talk about what goes into a cheese and tea pairing, because this is not a combination that we all have probably necessarily thought of a great deal.
Well, if you think about tea, it has a lot of the same characteristics as wine, as well as tannins, which wine, of course, contains. And you can have very light, very delicate teas as well as very aged, robust, earthy teas. And they range the gamut from white teas, green teas, black teas, oolong teas, pu'er teas. There's so many different kinds of teas. Then you add in different flavorings. And a good tea maker like Rishi doesn't add flavors. They actually add things like real fruits and herbs and spices. But you can add those, for example, a perfect example of a tea and cheese pairing is to take a raspberry ale washed Bellavitano, which I know you've had, and then you pair it with a raspberry tea or a raspberry laced green tea, for example. Perfectly paired. What we have here today is I just brewed up some peach oolong because that's what I had been drinking this morning. And then I stopped at Clock Shadow and tasted a bunch of cheeses. And all four of these taste delicious, but they're all different. Let me introduce the cheeses, and then we can taste them one by one and taste them with the tea.
Okay.
The one other thing I will say which makes tea a very good beverage with cheese is it's warm. And the warmth of the tea can enhance the flavors and the taste of a cheese. So let's start with – we'll start with the chutney.
Okay.
Cheese, because it's just – it's creamy, but it's also very sweet.
And this is the same company that makes the South African sausages.
Yes.
And we are trying this with – these are rice crackers.
It's lovely. It's sweet. Oh. It's creamy. Mm. It would taste great on your bagel instead of cream cheese, but it would also be great to add to a sandwich for a sweet and savory note. Taste them with the tea.
And they are a very nice complement to each other.
You pick up the floral notes of the tea, you pick up the floral or sweet notes in the cheese.
This is it's a very sweet cheese.
Because the chutney is sweet.
That is delicious. I'm going to have more.
I think you should. Now, the next one we're going to go with is the brick.
Okay.
It's just it's not a very strong brick. It's a very mild brick.
Very creamy brick.
Creamy, a little bit nutty, but not too nutty.
I like to think of myself that way. Also a very nice pairing with the peach oolong.
It's very smooth. It's complimentary.
And it's interesting how the peach oolong blends in so nicely with both something that was very sweet and something that was very mild.
Exactly.
We are onto the Colby.
We're onto the Colby. Traditional Wisconsin cheese.
And Colby was invented in Wisconsin, correct?
In Colby, Wisconsin. Yep. So it's creamier.
That is a delicious Colby.
It's one of those. It's very creamy, but very, very mild. Colby's a very mild cheese with tiny holes, similar to cheddar, but different cultures.
And I think I like the peach oolong with the brick more than I like it with the Colby.
Exactly. Still goes well, but the Colby, while also mild, isn't as nutty.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't pair with the tea quite as well.
So we are on to the Montague?
Yes, which is a more heavily aged cheese.
And tell us a little bit more about the Montague.
It is, you can taste, this is a lot nuttier.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit earthy, almost grassy. You can almost taste the grass that the cows and sheep grazed on. It's aged. So aging enhances flavors, and it's different because it's two different kinds of milks. Combined.
This is the sheep and cows.
And sheep milk typically has a higher fat content than cow's milk, which has a different effect on cheese making, which is why when you combine milks, it has a different effect. You have to know how to combine and so that they don't separate and taste horrible. That's one interesting thing about Wisconsin cheeses, which I've talked about before. Wisconsin is one of the few areas of the country, if not the world, that combines different kinds of milk into singular cheeses. You can have cow and goat. You can have sheep and goat. You can often have cow, goat, and sheep.
I think you may have brought us cow, goat, and sheep the last time you were here.
And part of that reason, if you look at it, we don't only make a lot of cow's milk in Wisconsin, but we also make a lot of goat's milk and sheep's milk. In fact, we produce more goat's milk and sheep's milk than any other state.
I will say, by the way, that I like the peach oolong tea with the Montague more than I liked it with the Colby, but still not quite as much as I liked it with the brick.
Well, the brick, it's, again, very mild, light, floral, and if you wanted to make it an even better pairing, get some peach preserves and add that to the top of the cheese. And then you pick up the peach, you pick up the earthiness, it's a good combination. And again, when you add things, whether it's for tea or wine or cocktails or bourbon, whatever beverage you have, if there are certain aromas, whether they're peach or smoke or whatever it happens to be, although I wouldn't pair cheese with tobacco, and I know some wines have aromas of tobacco,
right.
You you take something and you create a bridge. If something has grapefruit notes, add a grapefruit chutney or a grapefruit jam. If something has cherry notes, some cherry preserves, things like that, or a dish that has cherries in it with the cheese, that's one of the principles of pairing.
I'm honestly dazzled by the brick.
Isn't it wonderful?
It really is.
And it came from cow's milk here in, well, West Allis, but the Milwaukee area.
It's not a variety that I'd given a lot of thought to before now, but I feel like I'm going to seek out more.
It's a delicious variety. I love fresh bricks.
Let me ask you a question before we go here. The Big Cheese event that you are presenting at, as we said, this is an event that you would have no doubt gone to even if you weren't on the on the agenda. What are the other aspects of this conference that you are most looking forward to?
I love the fact that you can mingle and meet cheesemakers. I've met a lot of our local cheesemakers, but if you're just a typical person, unless you're going to an event like this or going to visit the cheesemakers on their farms, you probably won't get to meet cheesemakers. Anytime you can bridge a connection between what you eat and who makes what you eat is really special. Anytime I go to the store, whether I've met a cheesemaker or a bread maker or a farmer who produces meat, one of those things, I'll look at those brands and immediately a person will come to mind, not just a thing. And I think that's really special. Also, you can take cheese making classes. You can take just one, go for one seminar, or you can get a day pass, or you can come for the whole weekend, depending on how cheesy you're feeling. And it's the Osthoff is not that far away from Milwaukee. So if you just want to go for a day and learn how to make fresh mozzarella or take a cheese and wine pairing class or go to one of the dinners, it would be a fun thing to do.
Well, Jeanette Hurt, always wonderful to see you. Thank you for bringing these terrific cheeses again and opening my eyes and hopefully everyone's eyes to the idea of pairing cheese and tea.
Thanks, Mitch.
Jeanette Hurt is Lake Effect's regular ambassador to the world of Wisconsin cheeses. She's also the author of a number of books and will be part of the Big Cheese event at the Osthoff Resort in Elkhart Lake that begins tomorrow. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.